The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 26.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. I am going solo again for this one, and I'm actually starting a three-part series on capital and interest theory in the Austrian tradition. So this is my specialty in terms of academic research. That's largely what my doctoral dissertation was on. And somebody in the supporters group suggested that I talk more about my problems with what's called the pure time preference theory, so that they knew that I had critiqued Mises and that I was skeptical of the standard Austrian view when it comes to explaining interest in the market economy, what's called the pure time preference theory. And so that's the inspiration for this. And the reason I'm doing a three-part series is just there's really a lot of material. And in order for you to understand my critique of the Austrian theory, we kind of need to start way back with Eugen von Bumbavark. And if for no other reason, we need to start there just so I can say the guy's name. Because really, with a name like that, people really ought to be talking about you. So I'm not going to just do three episodes back to back to back. I will have other stuff interspersed. I'm getting ready to replay something that I did in the Laura Murphy Show. So you'll hear that next episode. And then also before the third installment of this three-part series drops, I certainly will have at least one, possibly two more interviews that are ripening and ready for distribution. So just watch the headlines, the title of the podcast episodes, if you want to see parts two and three of this. And of course, on any of those, I'll link back to this. So by the time the third one drops, you can have the links to the three episodes as they occur. So let me give you right now an outline, a schedule as to where we're going. So here in this part one of three on our series devoted to capital and interest theory in the Austrian tradition, I'm going to be talking about Bumbavark's critique of what he called the naive productivity theory of interest. And I will also, after I walk through that, devote the last segment of this episode to juxtaposing Bumbavark's critique of the naive productivity theory with the standard explanation of interest that you would get if you got a master's or PhD in economics at a standard university nowadays. So just to give you a little hint of what I mean by that, right now you go through a normal economics program and they're going to teach you that in equilibrium with competitive markets, the equilibrium wage rate is equal to the marginal product of labor, and the equilibrium real rate of interest is equal to what they call the marginal product of capital. And a regular economist who hasn't studied much in terms of the history of economic thought and knows about these controversies in capital and interest theory would think that is perfectly straightforward. Like, yeah, duh, labor gets paid its marginal product, namely wages, and capitalists get paid their marginal product, namely interest. What's the problem? They would think, duh. And there's actually a huge problem with that. And I struggled in terms of plotting out this episode and the order in which I presented things to you guys. Like, should I present that first? And I decided not to, both for historical reasons, because in terms of what I'm going to talk about, chronologically speaking, Bumbavark's critique of the naive productivity theory certainly happened before Irving Fisher's exposition of what's considered to be modern standard interest rate theory, and certainly the mathematical versions of it that now dominate any standard mainstream program. So there's that. So it's got that going for it, which is nice. But also, and I've noticed this, like when I would teach this stuff at Mises University, I would like explain, this is how the mainstream people do it. And then I would show what was wrong with it. And since it was a long involved lecture that was an hour long, by the end of it, you know, there's the primacy effect that where people just remember the first thing you said. And so people had filed away the stuff I was like putting up there and saying, now this is wrong. And here's why. And people didn't remember the why. And they just remember the first thing I said, which was, you know, I was presenting to the knockdown. So for those two reasons, I'm going to first explain to you guys again the way Bumbavrk approached this issue and specifically his critique of what he called the naive productivity theory. And then after that's done, I will, in a briefer fashion, explain the standard mainstream mathematical approach and explain why that's wrong. So general listeners will certainly get something out of this first part that I'm going to try to focus on. It won't involve anything complicated. Whereas the latter part, I mean, for sure, if you're a professional economist or you're a grad student or something, you're definitely going to want to listen to that because what I'm going to say might help you reconcile these things yourself. Just to go on a quick, really quick tangent, what happened was I was in grad school at NYU doing my normal coursework where in the mathematical models we were using, it had to be the case that, yeah, in equilibrium, R equals MPK, right? The real interest rate equals the marginal product of capital. That wasn't wrong. I understood how they were deriving it, and they were correct to conclude that in terms of these mathematical models. And yet I also could read Bumbavrk, or at least the English translation of him, and what he was saying was correct. And it seemed like they couldn't both be correct at the same time, and I figured out what was going on. So I'll save that for the end. The suspense, I hope, is not too painful for you, that you can deal with it. But I will resolve that mystery. And it's not something cute. Like, it's actually a pretty cool thing. So that's another reason I'm doing this. In case I get hit by a bus next week, I want to make sure I codify my contribution to economic theory. Okay, so with all those caveats out of the way, let's jump right in. Obviously, the show notes page, so right now we're listening to, or you're listening to, I'm listening to myself say it, episode 26. So you go to bobmurphyshow.com/26 if you want to get the links backing this stuff up. I'm going to try to keep this more conversational and casual because I've written this stuff up elsewhere, obviously. And so I think if I don't look at too many notes and things like that and just kind of talk to you as if I'm being forced on the spot to explain what's the big picture here, Bob, that maybe that will help me to say it in a way that's more understandable for regular listeners. And also, even for those of you who have tried to read my dissertation, for example, maybe I'll say something in this exposition that will make it click for you. So Bumbavrk, just so you get an idea who he was, he is like, so Menger's the founder of Austrian economics. His book comes out in 1871. And then Bumbavrk is like the next wave. And the way I explain it is that Bumbavrk took the subjective marginal utility approach to value theory that Menger invented. And Bumbavrk applied it in an intertemporal, meaning over time, framework. And that's how Bumbavrk ended up making major contributions to what's called capital and interest theory. And by the way, it's not just Austrian fanboys who like Menger and Bumbavrk. Even in standard histories of economic thought, like Joseph Schumpeter or, you know, others that you might read, everybody agrees that the so-called marginal revolution of the early 1870s was ushered in by three pioneers, namely Carl Menger, William Stanley Jevons, and Leon Walras. So that is how standard histories of economic thought approach it. And also somebody like Irving Fisher, who is the godfather of modern mainstream interest theory, you read his path-breaking works, and he also gives plenty of credit to Bumbavrk as an inspiration. So again, this isn't just Austrians trying to elevate their heroes. Regular giants in the history of economic thought acknowledge the contributions of Menger and von Bavarck. Okay, so if you have seen what's titled as Capital and Interest by von Bavarck, it's often in three volumes that are slapped together. It's a very handsome-looking volume. But book one of that is A History and Critique of Interest Theories. And so that came out in the early 1880s. And then the second volume of, actually I think it's called volume one. The second volume of that is then von Bavarck's Positive Theory of Capital. And then the third volume in that way that they group it after the fact, I think is titled Further Essays on Capital and Interest, something like that, where von Bavarck's responding to his critics. All right, so in terms of that structure, that first volume, it's an amazing tour de force where von Bavarck comes up with a taxonomy in which he classifies every possible type of explanation for the phenomenon of interest in a market economy. And then he goes through and he'll populate his framework with specific examples. Like, so, oh, there's the exploitation theory of interest. And then he'll put in particular writers who fit into that box. And, there's the abstinence theory of interest. And then he'll list writers and quote from them who fit that box and so forth. And then he'll go through and critique it. So by the time it's done, von Bavarck has shown, in his mind at least, why every other person in human history who's ever tried to explain the phenomenon of interest has ultimately fallen short. Then in the second volume, his positive theory, von Bavarck gives what he thinks the correct explanation is. And then in the third volume, he responds to people who criticized his own theory or explanation. Okay, so what I'm going to do now here in terms of the three-part series, part one, you're now listening to episode 26, this is part one, I'm going to focus on, from that first volume, von Bavarck's critique of what he labeled the naive productivity theory of interest. And then, like I say, I'm going to, at the end, reconcile von Bavarck's critique with what seems to be a contradictory modern approach to interest theory. And I'll show you that it's actually not contradictory, even though it seems like it is. In part two of this series here on the Bob Murphy Show, which again might not be episode 27, it'll be something later, I'm going to then explain von Bavarck's positive theory, explain his own explanation for interest, and then I will also explain why Frank Fetter and Ludwig von Mises criticized von Bavarck. And just to anticipate a little bit, we'll see that here in this part one, I'm going to explain von Bavarck's critique of the naive productivity theory. Then when von Bavarck offers his own exposition, productivity plays a role in it. And so Frank Fetter and then Mises picked up on it, are going to say, well, geez, that's kind of surprising. Von Bavarck did such a masterful job showing why the productivity of capital has nothing intrinsically to do with interest. And yet, for some reason, ironically, frustratingly, von Bavarck relapsed into the old productivity fallacies that he himself had blown up. Huh. Well, so much the worse for von Bavarck. Let's take what's good in his theory and salvage it. And then that's what they did. So part of what I did in my dissertation was a qualified defense of von Bavarck to say Fetter and Mises misunderstood what von Bavarck was doing. He did not, his own positive theory did not commit the same fallacy that he had just blown up in his earlier volume. So I know this gets confusing and nuanced, but I'm not saying I agree with von Bavarck's theory. All I'm saying is he didn't contradict himself. If you think von Bavarck's critique of what he called the naive productivity theory blows up his own positive explanation, you're wrong. It doesn't. And so that's, I'll explain all that too. Then finally, in part three of this three-part series on the Bob Murphy Show, I'm going to then give my critique of the Misesian theory, the pure time preference theory of interest. Okay, so that's the perhaps audacious task we now have before us, and that's the material I want to summarize. Okay, so here, now that we're doing part one, von Bavarck's critique of the naive productivity theory. So as I mentioned, he had a whole taxonomy of different types of theories. In the show notes page, I'll link to articles I wrote for Mises.org where I summarize some of Bumbavork's critiques, because it's really well done. I mean, Bumbavork is a rhetorical genius. He will take a theory and build it up such that by the end of it, he's convinced you. You think that theory is right. Like, he's done a better job propounding it than its own believers have done. Then he knocks it down. Then he builds it back up and takes away the argument he just used to knock it down and say, suppose I can't use that argument. Oh, look, there's this other completely independent argument with which I can blow up this theory. And sometimes with certain theories, he does that like two or three times. In other words, he's got like multiple independent arguments, any one of which is fatal to the theory that 5 minutes earlier he had you believing because he did such a good job of presenting it. And then, again, depending on this, so with some of these, it's more true than others, Bumbavork will say, okay, now I've surely convinced you, the reader, that that theory can't be right, but yet it sure seemed like it was right, didn't it, when I explained it originally? So what's going on here? Well, this is what's going on. And then you'll be like, oh, yeah, okay. And so obviously he didn't speak in such colloquial language. He was very formal in German in the way he wrote, but that's what he's doing rhetorically. And so when you walk away from it, you just understand the issue so much better than when you started. It's amazing, right? And so I think I captured the flavor of some of that in the summaries I did in these Mises.org articles, again, that I'll link to in the show notes page. So my takeaway, just in case it's not clear, is I'm saying this isn't merely of interest to historians of economic thought. You know, in other words, you might think, why the heck would I go and look up and see what is a wrong theory of interest that was prevalent back in the 1870s? What do I care? And the point is not for you to go learn that wrong theory. The point is, by you reading Bumbavork blow it up, you learn correct economics. And it's what's really great. It's in particular, subjective value theory, because that comes up a lot, that Bumbavork kind of clarifies, like, no, actually, what this guy's calling a cost is really a reduced benefit. And those are different things, you know, that sort of stuff. Okay, so the focus of this episode is Bumbavork's critique of what he called the naive productivity theory of interest. And incidentally, before I forget, let me just mention that right there is a good tip-off to show why Fetter and Mises were wrong when they said Bumbavork relapsed into the old productivity fallacies. I mean, in other words, the word naive there isn't redundant. Bumbavork was not saying any theory of interest that involves productivity is wrong because of this argument I'm about to give. He was saying a naive productivity theory is wrong for this argument I'm going to give. Okay, so again, especially for those of you who are card-carrying professional Austrian economists right now, who when you read Human Action and its treatment of Bumbavork, and you think, yeah, Mises just crushed it. Silly Bumbavork, I wonder why he forgot his own lessons. I would just challenge you and say, what's that word naive doing when Bumbavork talks about the productivity? Why didn't he just call it the productivity theory? It's what's that word naive doing? And once you answer that, I think you'll see that, again, maybe Bumbavork was wrong, and I actually think he was. I don't think it was a good theory of interest, but he was not contradicting himself, that his own theory survives the critique he leveled against the naive productivity theory of interest, because Bumbavork would have classified his own explanation as one that was not naive. Okay, so in order to understand how Bumbavork approaches this, you need to know what is the problem to be explained. What is it that the economist has to do if he or she, but when Bumbavork was writing, he would have said he, is going to solve the problem of interest or to explain interest theoretically? And so what Bumbavork was trying to do is he's trying to explain, why is it that the capitalist can systematically, in a regular setting, earn an income? Or another way of putting it is, why can the capitalist typically enjoy a perpetual flow of consumption, even though the capitalist is not seemingly contributing anything in terms of scarce resources into the project? So in contrast, like, it makes perfect sense. Why can a laborer earn an income? because, oh, labor's scarce, labor carries disutility, and so it makes sense that a worker inputs, if you will, several hours into a project, and so the owner has to, you know, give him compensation for that. And then likewise, somebody who owns farmland that's very fertile, it makes sense that year after year when there's the harvest, the owner of that farmland gets to keep some of the crops, you know, some of the produce. That makes sense. What Bombavrick was trying to explain, he said, when it comes to interest, is why is it that the capitalist, the person who owns funds, can invest in a project and then take out of it, when all is said and done, not only his original investment, but money above and beyond that, such that he could then go buy consumption goods. And thus he can consume and then still have that capital value intact, which he can then reinvest and do the whole thing over again. All right. So in the real world, of course, there's profit and loss, that if, you know, somebody made a faulty judgment, thought a project was going to be profitable and it wasn't, the capitalist might lose capital value. But Bombavrick is saying, you know, in regular occurring affairs where things happen as people generally anticipate, it's not merely that the capitalist breaks even, but instead expects to enjoy a positive return. Okay. By the way, I'm paraphrasing. I'm using some modern terminology. This might not be the exact way Bombavrick expressed these things, but that's certainly the spirit of what he was asking. Okay. So he's saying that's what the economist or the economic theorist needs to explain. And so again, Bombavrick then comes up with this taxonomy where he classifies every type of theory of interest he's encountered up to that point when he's writing, and just goes through and shows why each type of theory misses the mark and does not answer that question the way he's formulated it. Okay, so the naive productivity theory explains interest by saying capital is productive. And there's different meanings that attributed to that. Just for the sake of brevity, let's focus on one that's substantive, that says, okay, what we mean by that is with actual capital goods, you can produce more than you can without the capital goods. And let's further suppose the increment in output that you get is more valuable to you, right? So that the finished product has a higher value, both in subjective terms and in market value terms, than what you would get if you didn't include the capital good in the production process. Okay, so Bombavrick's saying, suppose that's what you mean by the phrase capital is productive. And so then Bombavrick wants to ask, can we explain why is it that capitalists, the people who have financial capital, why are they able to invest in a productive process and then, when all is said and done, get back not only their original investment, but have an increment above that, which they could consume if they wanted to? Can you explain that outcome by saying, well, capital is productive? Or by saying more specifically, you can get more output that you can then sell for more money if you use capital goods than if you don't use capital goods. Does that make sense? So Bombavrick, first of all, concedes the underlying premises. He says, yes, I totally grant you that at least certain types of capital goods are productive in the sense that you produce more stuff with them than without them. I also grant that in practice, the way they're used, they're devoted towards processes, towards production activities, such that the increase in output is more valuable than if you didn't do it. All right. And by just a really quick tangent, I mean, you could imagine a scenario where if you weren't guided rationally, you might use capital goods to produce too much of something, where you said, geez, I wish we didn't have so much of this, right? You're producing so much soda that it's falling over onto the floor and getting the floor sticky or something, right? So that's in case you're confused. I mean, you could logically imagine a situation where you would actually have preferred to have less physical output. Okay, but Bombavrick's saying, let's assume the stuff is chosen wisely such that the capital goods are producing more stuff, and given human desires and preferences, people actually prefer that augmented amount of output rather than what would have happened without the contribution of the capital goods. Okay, great. Now Bombavrick asks the ultimate important question. is there any reason in that explanation per se that we would expect the boost in market value of the output stemming from the contribution of the capital good to be higher than the original purchase price of the capital good? Because that's really the issue. It's not enough, when Bavrick said, to tell me that capital goods are physically productive, and it's not even enough to say that that enhancement or that augmentation of the physical amount of output carries a higher or commands a higher return in the marketplace, or a higher price, I should say, in the marketplace. That by itself does not demonstrate that the original amount you had to spend to acquire that capital good is lower than that augmented value and the output. So let me just use specific numbers here just to illustrate the issue. So imagine there's a farmer who has an operation, and if he adds a tractor into the mix, he every harvest gets a bigger harvest, and including the operating costs of the tractor every year, if he were just given the tractor for free, then every year he would get $10,000 more in net income. Okay, so he would get enough crops over and above what he otherwise would have harvested, sells them for more total dollars, and out of that boost in revenue, he can cover the operating costs, that, you know, the fuel or whatever, the oil and stuff that he needs for the tractor. Okay, so the having the tractor, if it were just given to him for free, brand new up front, in that first year of operation, even taking into account the extra money the farmer needs to spend operating the tractor, when all is said and done, he reaps a net income $10,000 higher than he otherwise would have. Okay, and suppose that's true for 10 years in a row, and then after that 10th year, the tractor just completely collapses and you can't even sell it for scrap. It just goes to being worthless as far as human goals are concerned. Okay, so unrealistic, but just keeps the analysis simple. Okay, so for 10 years in a row, the farmer is going to reap net income of $10,000 if he has this tractor, if it were just given to him as a free gift up front, as a brand new tractor. So notice this fulfills the requirements or the attributes that the naive productivity theory posited. Namely, the tractor is physically productive. You get more total crops harvested with it than without. And we assume the market value, even including the cost of operation of that enhanced output, is positive. Okay. Nonetheless, did I just prove to you that the farmer, by investing financial capital in the tractor, is going to earn a net rate of return on his investment? No, I didn't. What I just showed you is if he had that tractor for free as a gift up front, 10 years in a row, he would get an extra $10,000 in net income. But what if, so now he's not giving it for free. What if now I'm telling you, no, the farmer has to go into the marketplace and buy this new tractor if he wants to. Is he going to earn an interest return on his investment? And the answer is, well, it depends what that purchase price is of the tractor. Suppose, for example, the original purchase price of the tractor is $100,000. So then the farmer spends $100,000 buying a tractor, and each year of its life, it gives him $10,000 in net income. So after the 10 years passes by, all the farmer has done is recoup his original $100,000. So what I'm saying is the physical productivity of the tractor is consistent with there being a 0% rate of return, nominal rate of return on investment. And yet, as I say, that's, you know, everything else in that story fits the attributes that the naive productivity theorists said would be true. Okay, so that right there is Bombavrick's critique, or the essence of his critique of the naive productivity theory of interest. Bombavrick actually shows that, if anything, the naive productivity theory explanation goes the wrong way. Because in order to explain why is it that somebody investing financial capital in acquiring a tractor to then incorporate it into a productive enterprise, in order to explain why that person down the road ends up with more dollars than he originally pumped into it, you need to explain why is the initial purchase price of that tractor lower than the expected future rents it's expected to yield. Okay, so at time zero, the farmer thinks the tractor will give a flow of $10,000 per year for 10 years. So at a 0% discount rate, that would be a present value of $100,000. So in order for there to be an expected positive rate of interest, or there would have to be a positive discount rate involved, meaning that initial purchase price would be less than $100,000. Right? So if originally the farmer only had to spend $90,000 to get that tractor, and then, you know, year after year just kept taking that $10,000 and putting it under his mattress, after the 10 years, he would have a net $10,000 gain, right? He would have $100,000 even though he originally pumped in $90,000. So he would have gained $10,000. Okay, so again, what Bombavrik was pointing out was when the economic theorist has to explain in terms of basic fundamentals the essence of interest, in a sense, what he's trying to do is explain the apparent undervaluation of productive capital goods, things that are expected to have a long life and to contribute to output over time. In order for them to bestow a positive financial rate of return on those who invest in them, their original purchase price, in a sense, has to be lower than what they're ultimately expected to yield over time. And it's only if that's the case that the person investing in it will earn a positive rate of return. And so Bombavrik's point is, if what you're really needing to explain to me is this apparent undervaluation, this mismatch, this fact that the immediate purchase price of capital goods is lower than what they're ultimately expected to yield over time, if that's what you need to explain to me, well, then telling me, oh, it's because those capital goods are productive and they contribute to output and that's why, you know, they're valuable. No, that's going the wrong way, right? In other words, you need to be coming up with explanations for why something's wrong with these things. Because just at face value, you're telling me they're productive and they're going to contribute to a boost in output that's not only a physical boost in terms of, you know, physical measurements of output, but also is higher in market value. That doesn't explain to me why this thing's being undervalued. That's just explaining why it has value at all. All right. Another way of putting this is to say the productivity of the tractor, what that actually explains is its rental rate or its rental price per unit time. All right. So the fact that the tractor, when it's used, when it's incorporated into the farmer's operations, the fact that each year that it's in service, the farmer has a net income that's $10,000 higher than it otherwise would have been. That explains why the farmer, if he were just renting the tractor for a year from a different owner, right? So the farmer's not buying the tractor. He's just paying for the temporary use of it. That explains why the farmer would be willing to pay up to $10,000 per year. And in a competitive market, you would expect he would have to pay $10,000 or just shy of it, right? So the productivity of the tractor, if again, what we mean by that is the fact that it augments physical output such that all things considered, the person using it has an income that's $10,000 higher than otherwise would be, that marginal productivity of the tractor doesn't explain interest rates or rates of return. It explains the rental price of the tractor. Just like the physical productivity, or sorry, the marginal productivity of labor, which includes physical things, but also subjective valuation, the fact that you add one more worker to the mix boosts physical output, which also commands a higher market price when you sell it. That explains the wage rate. So that explains, if you will, how much you have to pay to rent a worker temporarily. Same token, the physical productivity of capital goods explains how much you have to pay to rent capital goods temporarily. It explains their price per unit time. The rate of return from someone investing in a capital good isn't about the rental price. Rather, it's about the ratio of the initial purchase price to the cumulative rental prices over time. Okay, so I'm saying the same thing several different ways to hopefully make it click with you. So that's Bombavrick's critique. So he wasn't saying there that productivity has nothing to do with anything, or that it doesn't play some role in the ultimate understanding of what's going on with interest. But he's saying the mere fact that capital goods are productive, if that's what you're citing, well, and that's what you mean, they say, oh yeah, the reason people earn a positive rate of interest when they invest their funds into capital goods, the reason is, oh, because those capital goods are productive. That's the naive productivity theory. And Bombavrick pretty decisively blew that up. He said, no, that's you're only comparing one little piece of the puzzle there. The real source of interest is the fact that initial purchase price is less than the summation of all the future rental prices, if that's the way you want to think about it. So just telling me things that clearly just determine the rental price, your dimensions aren't even right. You don't even understand what you're trying to explain.
Folks, let's take a break from my discussion of Bombavrick and his critique of the naive productivity theory to talk about Liberty Classroom. If you like what you're hearing in this episode, well, why not multiply it, I don't know, 30-fold, 40-fold, and hear me talk about all kinds of other economists and their contributions. So I have a 2-part series in the history of economic thought at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. Of course, you can also hear Tom teaching on all manner of historical topics. So there's plenty of other professors involved too. The last thing I'll mention, if you are interested, don't just go to libertyclassroom.com. Ignore that URL I just said. I want you to go to the show notes page of this episode, which is bobmurphyshow.com/26. And in the show notes page, click on my link for Liberty Classroom, because it's calibrated so that I get a little something extra. You know what I'm talking about? No reason for Tom Woods to have all the fun. So please go to bobmurphyshow.com/26, check out the links, and you'll see one going to Liberty Classroom. You click on that and let the learning begin.
Okay, so I think that's enough time spent to summarize the gist of Bombavrick's critique of the naive productivity theory. So let me now turn. So if you got that and you're like, you know what, I'm good, Bob. I've learned something today. Now I'm going to go watch TV. I don't blame you. Fair enough. Keep up the good fight. But for those of you who are true fans of economic theory, and especially if you're in grad school or beyond, let me try to say this somewhat briefly, but I want to reconcile what I just walked through with the modern mainstream neoclassical approach to interest that you would find in a mathematical model. So like I say, here there does seem to be a certain symmetry involved where everybody, including Austrians, agrees that in a regular model of a competitive market economy where factors of production are paid according to their marginal product, the equilibrium wage rate is equal to the marginal product of labor. And what we mean by that is, well, you know, someone's got an operation going, they hire a worker, one more hour of a worker's labor time. Again, with competitive labor markets, how much does that worker get paid? He tends to get paid the market value of the marginal product of his labor. So you hire one more worker, and that means your factory produces 3 more widgets per hour than it otherwise would have, and the widgets sell for $4 each. So that means by hiring that worker, you're getting 12 more dollars of revenue per hour. And assuming that you don't have to, you know, buy other inputs to increase production, then that worker should be getting paid just about $12 an hour. Because if he weren't getting paid that, then some other factory would bid him away, that kind of stuff. And he wouldn't get paid more than that because then the firm would be losing money. There you go. Okay, so that's the standard approach for labor. And so again, in these mainstream models, when they want to explain, okay, well, that's the equilibrium wage rate. What's the equilibrium real rate of interest? And in the terms of saying real, we mean adjusted for price inflation. So in these models, a lot of times they don't even have money. It's just in terms of, it's like a barter economy. I know if you're like a normal person hearing this, you're going to freak out and say, are you kidding me? You're telling me these MIT and these other big name schools where they're cranking out people to go run the Fed. The standard models don't even have money. Okay, so number one, yes, I am saying that. Number two, in this context, it's not as crazy as that sounds, that there's a certain rationale to, hey, let's start simple. It's kind of like you're explaining free trade to somebody and you want to do show them comparative advantage. You just do, you got two countries with two goods, or like England and France, and they're making sweaters and bottles of wine and they're trading with each other. It would complicate it if you had pounds and francs in there and had the exchange rate. It would just, it would make it too complicated. It's easier to demonstrate the principles of comparative advantage just having people trade in terms of barter. All right. So likewise here, if we're trying to distill the essence of payments to factors of production under competitive market conditions, it actually is cleaner to say, let's get rid of money and just imagine the worker goes into the factory, and that means every hour, three more widgets are produced. So the real wage in equilibrium for the worker is three widgets per hour. You can even imagine the factory owner actually giving widgets to the worker, if you want to think of it that way. And so, you know, of course, really what's happening is he's getting paid enough money to then go in the marketplace and be able to afford the equivalent of three widgets. So what was that, $12? I think I said if it was $4 per widget. So he's getting paid $12 because that fetches three widgets in the marketplace. Okay, but if all of a sudden prices doubled and his dollar payments would get doubled too, his wages would get doubled in money terms, but his real wages would be the same. All right, so in these models, in these simple basic models that you learn just when you're starting out, there isn't money, but you know, I wouldn't worry too much about that. Because again, what they're trying to explain is the real exchange rates of things. They're trying to explain like real wages, and they're trying to explain the real interest rate. So the real interest rate is saying if you gave up present goods, you know, if you gave up an apple today and got a certain amount of money and then invested it, got interest next period, and then went and bought apples in the marketplace, how many apples would you be able to get? So if you gave up an apple today in order to get 1.1 apples next year, that's a 10% rate of return, at least measured in apples. So if apples are the only consumption good, that's a 10% real rate of interest. All right. So that's kind of the way these things work. So anyway, when a mainstream economist is asked, okay, I totally get now how wage rates are set, at least in this hypothetical world of competitive labor markets, what about the interest rate? And they're going to say, oh, it's very analogous. Just like labor contributes to enhancing output, likewise, so does capital. And if you have more capital being put into a production process, the amount of total output goes up. And so if factors of production are being paid according to their marginal product, well then duh, in equilibrium in a competitive market, capital receives its marginal product. And so since we think capital earns interest just like labor earns wages, then the equilibrium real rate of interest equals the marginal product of capital. So that's how they'd say it in words. And then if you wanted to see it in terms of a simple mathematical model, I'd say, yeah, sure, I can do that. Let's say you have F and then parentheses of K comma L, close parentheses. So some function that takes capital and labor as inputs, you know, equals something. And then the derivative of F with respect to L equals W star, right? So the first derivative of that production function F with respect to the labor input is equal to the equilibrium real wage rate, which is denoted by W star. And the first derivative of F with respect to K, the capital input, equals R star. And they could go ahead and write out specific functional form if they wanted, you know, the one that made sense where it's increasing in both K and L, but the second derivative is negative, right? So that you add more labor, output keeps going up, but the more labor you add, the increment gets smaller and smaller, right? So there's diminishing marginal returns, that kind of stuff. You could make simplifying assumptions and reasonable assumptions like that, and you go ahead and just do it mathematically. And it's got to be the case,
in a world like that, that, yep, if you just think through the logic of it, it has to be true that the derivative of the production function with respect to capital equals the real rate of interest, and that, yes, that is the exchange rate of consumption now with consumption next period. Okay, so the premium placed on present consumption versus future consumption does have to equal that derivative of the production function with respect to one more unit of capital being put in there. You can show that mathematically and it makes sense economically and it checks out. Okay, yep, there's no problem there with the math. And the economic intuition behind it is also right. And yet, wait a minute, what the heck? It sure seems like in that world, we just show that the explanation, the reason in equilibrium there's going to be a positive real rate of interest is that capital goods are physically productive. And yet, didn't I just spend 25 minutes or so earlier in this episode showing how Eugen von Bombaverk verbally blew up such an explanation? And I think to the extent that modern economists became aware of Bombaverk's critique, they would think he must have been wrong. So for sure, Paul Samuelson said Bombaverk was wrong, but it gets really sophisticated there in nuance. I mean, Samuelson was a sharp guy, so I'll also link. By the way, before I forget, let me just pat myself on the back. Two of my peer-reviewed articles for the Journal of History of Economic Thought, do you know who my peer was that reviewed it? Paul Samuelson. What's up? What's up, folks? Mic drop. So I'll link to that stuff just so you can see that. Because also, and the reason I know that is he disclosed his identity. Right, I got the referee report and I opened it up and it said, I'm disclosing this is Paul Samuelson. I almost fell out of my chair. Okay, so in any event, Samuelson thought Bombaverk was wrong, but he was a more sophisticated thing. What I'm saying here is a different claim, namely that I think modern economists who have been taught standard interest rate theory to say, oh, yeah, interest is the marginal product of capital, and to the extent they thought through that and what it means, if you showed them Bombaverk's critique, I think they would just say, well, I don't get what's going on here. I mean, this is why we use mathematical models nowadays. Because when, yeah, those guys back in the 1800s, when they were just writing long essays, they could be talking in circles or contradictory. Yeah, this is why we formalize stuff. This is the whole point. I can pin it down, this mathematical model, and it works. There's no contradiction. There's no circular argument. This works. There you go. There's a simple model to show what I'm talking about. And so if this Bombaverk guy thinks there's something wrong here, it's because he fooled himself and he's doing philosophy. He's not doing economics. I think that's what they would say, and they're wrong. Okay, so here's what's going on. And this is one of the things I did in my dissertation, and it took me a while to figure it out. Because like I said, both things seemed right. Let me say it one more time just to make sure you understand the dilemma. Bombaverk's verbal critique of what he called the naive productivity theory sure as heck seemed valid. I totally got what he was saying. When, you know, once you get into his worldview and you see what his point is, you're like, oh yeah, that's totally right. The fact that capital goods are physically productive, the fact that you add one more unit of capital, if what you mean by that is like a machine or a tractor or whatever, drill press, hammer, you add more units of physical capital and it boost physical output and you're still getting more revenue from that. That by itself doesn't explain why the equilibrium real rate of interest is positive. And yet, in these simplistic baseline mathematical models of the economy, where there's a production function that takes capital and labor as inputs, it was also undeniable that in equilibrium, assuming competitive factor markets, it had to be the case that the real equilibrium interest rate was exactly equal to the marginal physical product of capital, to the boost in output due to an infinitesimal, in terms of calculus, increment in the amount of K. And so it looked like that was codifying the naive productivity theory, holding it up under the lights, and it seemed like it passed scrutiny. So what the heck? What's going on here? How can that be? Didn't Bombaverk show there's a fallacy involved? Okay, so like I say, it took me a while to figure out what was going on. And the answer is, in those standard workhorse models that you learn if you go into grad school in economics, there's only one good. So, and you can kind of see it because it's like out of the total output, you know, so you have F of taking K and L as arguments, and then you get output. And then that total output can be allocated either to consumption or to augmenting the capital stock, right? So in these models, there's like depreciation and stuff. You can reach a steady state. But if you just look at what the equations are saying and think about it, you realize that it's like there's a big pile of output, and then the agent can consume some of it and then leave the rest to augment the capital stock, so that what the agent doesn't consume physically goes into the production function for next period, if it's a discrete model, you know, like T plus one, T plus two, like that, to boost the, you know, the thing flowing out of F of K T plus one, L T plus one, next period. And so that's where the trade-off comes in, that the more you consume this period, that means your K T plus one is smaller next period, so output next period is smaller. Okay, but my point is, if you think through the logic of that, it's showing you it's the same units. It's the same physical thing. That you, it's, so it's like you're eating the machinery, or if you will, the consumption good, if you don't consume it, physically transforms into more of itself next period. So it's like sheep. And I'm not making that up to be flippant. That's actually Irving Fisher in some of his expositions to get people to understand this stuff. He imagines a real simple economy consisting just of sheep, right? Where you can consume sheep, or if you don't touch them, then they just multiply and the flock grows over time if you don't consume it. And so he was saying, in a world like that, the equilibrium real rate of interest has to be positive, and it's going to equal the physical growth of the sheep in terms of biology. Okay, so what I realized was Bombavik's critique of the naive productivity theory of interest can only work if there's at least two goods. And so another way of putting it is, these mainstream models, when they just boiled down the economy into a real simple model where there was just one good, they thought they were, just keeping things tractable, right? Let's just start with the simplest case where there's just one type of output good, and you can either consume some of it and then defer consumption and plug that back into the production function next period to get your new pile of output. And then yourself at time T plus one can decide how much to consume and how much to save and invest and plug it back into the production function for T plus two. Da, da, da. They think they're just, we're just making a simplifying assumption to keep stuff easy, without realizing that there's a qualitative issue going on. When you go from two goods down to one good, there's a huge leap there that destroys the possibility of seeing Bombavik's argument. And since in the real world, of course, there's more than one good, this is a case where that assumption is quite deadly, right? Because in general, the way economists and, you know, any theorist justifies using an unrealistically simple model is to say, well, it depends what the issue is that we're studying. And so long as our simplifying assumptions don't change the result of the question that we're trying to answer, the simplifying assumptions are good, because they, you know, they get rid of all the extraneous distractions and they let us isolate the true things under scrutiny in this particular investigation. But where that doesn't work is if your simplifying assumption changes the answer. If, you know, something's going on in the real world and then you assume that away to conclude the wrong thing in your model, well, then that's where that simplifying assumption is deadly. And so I'm saying that's what's happening here, that mainstream economists, if they think they're really isolating the essence of interest and capital by saying, let's just assume there's one good in the economy, and in that world, we can quite easily see that the derivative of F with respect to K equals R star. Therefore, we conclude in general, as a general rule of markets, the real rate of interest must be equal to the marginal physical product of capital, or the market value of the physical product of capital. No, that's wrong. The dimensions are wrong. That's messed up. it's not even that it's wrong. It doesn't make sense in a more general setting. It only makes sense in a one good model. All right, so there, and I demonstrated this in the appendix of my dissertation, and then I wrote a separate exposition of it for the Journal of History of Economic Thought. And the way I did it was I showed that I first came up with I first presented a too good model. I don't mean too good like T-O-O, like, man, my model's too good. Call the police and a fireman. It's too good. All right. What I mean is too T-W-O, good model, right? Where there's a machine or something that produces the consumption good. And then in that setting, I derived an expression for the equilibrium real rate of interest, and it was complicated. It certainly was not the marginal product of capital. There was more stuff going on. And then I showed, but what if we then imposed some conditions that would be true in a world of one good? And then I showed my more general expression collapse that simplified into a much simpler expression, which namely was, the real rate of interest is equal to the marginal product of capital. Okay, so, you know, it's kind of like, I'm not saying I'm Einstein, folks, but I'm saying it's analogous to how Einstein had his more general expressions for the behavior of objects. And then he showed that, or you could take those equations and then show, if the velocities and if the relative velocities involved are pretty low compared to the speed of light, notice these more general expressions boil down to Newton's laws. Okay, so that Newton's laws were like a special case of the more general. And by the way, that it's confusing because Einstein had the general theory of relativity. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about his special theory of relativity. But Newton's laws were a special case of the special theory. Okay, so that's what I'm saying. Likewise here, what I was showing, I give the more general expression of here's what the equilibrium real rate of interest is. And in that expression that I derived, one element of it was what you could call the physical product of capital goods, but there was other stuff going on. And I showed, in the special case where the physical capital good was the same thing as the consumption good that it was producing, there would be certain implications. And then notice when I plug those things in, those conditions in, a bunch of stuff cancels out, divides away, and boom, that general expression boils down to the much simpler statement that the equilibrium real interest rate equals the marginal product of capital. So again, I'll give you the formal definition or the derivation in the show notes page. Let me try, as I wrap this particular episode up, to give you an intuitive explanation, because I realize I just used a lot of jargon there. Suppose you have an apple tree, and the world only lasts for 10 periods. Okay, so we've got 10 periods to go before the universe ends. And every period, the apple tree shoots out 10 apples. And so right now, and suppose the apples are the unit of consumption in our economy. That's like the basket of goods. That's all people eat is apples. And so now I want to, and so the real rate of interest in that world means if I trade present apples for future apples, do I get more, right? So if the real rate of interest is 5%, what that means is right now, if I have 100 apples and I sell them for claims on apples to be delivered in one period, I can get claims on 105 apples. Right, so the real rate of interest on apples is 5%. If we're saying apples are the consumption good period in the economy, then that's what it would mean to say the real rate of interest. Okay. If you want to use money, it's the same thing. You say, okay, if you have enough money to buy 100 apples right now, and instead you lend it out, you buy bonds or whatever, the going market rate of interest, even if prices fluctuate, blah, 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 so long as, you know, the real rate of interest, if it's 5%, that means you're going to get enough money next period. So then you go out into the marketplace and you can afford to buy 105 apples. So no matter how you slice it, it means if you have command of 100 apples in the first period,
you can trade them away in order to buy, or you sell the 100 apples today in order to effectively buy 105 apples next period to be delivered to you then. All right. And notice if you could keep doing that every period, you could consume 5 apples and you'd maintain your capital stock of 100 apples. So notice too that that's going back to Bombavrick's original formulation of the problem. The capitalist in possession of 100 apples of purchasing power at time zero, so long as the real rate of interest is 5% forever, could perpetually consume 5 apples a year, even though he's not working, even though he doesn't have farmland that he's selling or contributing. It's just the command over that financial purchasing power is giving him this flow of perpetual consumption. Okay? And so, again, go back now to this more specific thought experiment. Suppose you've got a tree that each period shoots out 10 apples. And again, the world's going to end after 10 periods. So the tree is certainly physically productive. If you have a command of that tree, each period you're getting 10 real apples, an extra income. You can consume, your consumption can be 10 apples higher each period than it otherwise would be. So that certainly explains why the tree would have a positive rental price. But does it explain why someone would earn a positive rate of return by investing in the tree? And here, you know, you might be tempted to say, oh, yeah, because the tree is physically. No, we don't know. Suppose the parameters are such that the equilibrium intertemporal exchange rate among apples is 0% for every period. In other words, if you right now sold off 100 apples to buy claims to have apples delivered to you next period, the market value of those two things would be equivalent. So that 100 apples today trades for 100 apples to be delivered next period. By the way, if that bothers you, you know, it's impossible. Believe me, you can come up with ways to make that happen. So even if you believe in exogenous pure time preference, still you can imagine like that the quantity of apples each year goes down a little bit. Okay. And in which case the actual exchange rate on the margin could still be 1-for-1. All right. To you know, you could choose the numbers to exactly counterbalance that exogenous pure time preference you want so that the actual market exchange rates happens to be 1-for-1 over each time period. There's nothing to prevent that from happening. That's possible, even in an Austrian framework. Okay? So suppose that's the case. So what would happen? Initially, that tree would have a market price of 100 apples. So you can either think of it in terms of barter, or you can think of it in terms of money, where the amount of money you would need to buy one apple, well, you need 100 times that in order to buy one tree. Either way, it's equivalent. Okay, it's probably easier if you just abstract from money and think of it in terms of barter. So somebody who wanted that tree up front would have to have 100 apples in his possession, hand it over to the owner of the tree in order to get the tree. And then that first year or period, whatever I said, the tree shoots out 10 apples. So then you go into period two. And at that point, the market value of the tree would now be 90 apples. And so if you wanted to calculate your financial rate of return on your investment, you'd say, well, I initially put in 100 apples to buy the tree. Going into period two, I earned a flow of rental income of 10 apples, but I suffered a capital loss of 10 apples, right? Because the market value of my asset dropped by 10 apples, and that was perfectly offset by the rental income that it yielded of 10 apples. And so the market value of my property started out at 100 apples in period one, and then by period two, it was also 100 apples. So my rate of return was zero. My wealth went from having a market value of 100 apples to market value of 100 apples. That's a rate of return of 0%. Even though the tree is physically productive, even though I'm assuming competitive markets, that the tree can be rented out to earn its owner exactly what its marginal physical contribution is, or the market value of its physical contribution. Okay? And then, of course, going into the next period, the
value of the tree drops another 10. And then in the last period, the market value of the tree, depending on what the timing is, after it's spit out its 100th apple, the market value of the tree drops to zero. Because then we go into the next period and the world ends. All right, people would pay $0 for that apple tree right before the, you know, Thanos or whoever destroys everything. Okay? So I just showed you a scenario where, again, just kind of illustrating, again, Bombavrick's point here in a case of a tree producing apples, that the explanation of interest is not about the physical productivity of an instrument, whether we're talking about a machine or even in this case, something that's natural, a tree. That doesn't explain interest. If you wanted to have a positive interest rate, that initial purchase price of the tree would have to be less than 100 apples. And then given the other parameters I said, that would explain why there'd be a financial rate of return measured in apples over time. Okay? Great. Now, what if instead of that world, we instead imagine some shepherd with a flock of sheep, and that's the only good in the economy? And the way consumption and saving and investment work is that if you refrain from slaughtering sheep and, you know, consuming them, then they multiply into, you know, at a 5% rate. So 100 sheep in your flock this period, if you don't touch them, they multiply into 105 next period. And we're not worried about, you know, you're not shearing the sheep or anything. You could do pigs or something if you're getting confused and say, okay, what? But I don't want you to think, oh, wait, a pig makes bacon. And you're like, just try to think of it in terms of direct things. All right. So notice here what happens. If the good is sheep, and that's the capital and consumption good, and physically 100 sheep this period, if you don't touch them, turn into 105 sheep next period, then it does pin down that the real rate of interest measured in sheep has to be 5% per year. Whereas, again, the fact that a tree produces 10 apples per period if you don't cut it down, that did not pin down in any way what the rate of return measured in apples is. And the reason is because in that first example, there was a free variable, namely, at any given time, what the market price of the tree is measured in apples. So at the first time period, the tree was worth 100 apples. The next time period, the tree had dropped to 90 apples, then to 80, then to 70. And it was those capital losses that were exactly counterbalancing the rental income such that the rate of return, all things considered, was exactly 0%. In contrast, if there's only one good, so that the capital good and the consumption good are the same physical thing, well, then every period, I can't use that same trick. I can't say, oh, what if going into next period, the 105 sheep have the same market value as 100 sheep do that period? That can't work. How can 105 sheep have the same value as 100 sheep if they're the same physical thing? One sheep trades for one sheep, again, in the same time period. So in case you're getting confused, what is true is to say 100 sheep in period one has the same market value at that moment as 105 sheep to be delivered in period two have, right? So if you sold 100 sheep in period one for airtight claims on sheep to be delivered next period, you would get 105 of those claims. That's true, but that's not the issue. What was happening in the tree example was that as time passed, the spot price of the tree measured in apples kept going down. Whereas here, you can't have that trick. It can't be that every period, the market value of a sheep measured in sheep goes down. No, because it's the same physical thing. One sheep every period, the spot price of one sheep is always one sheep. Duh. So notice that's nothing to do with productivity and intertemporal exchange. That has just to do with the fact that things that are the same have the same price. Okay, so, and when I say trick, I don't mean like there's something sneaky going on. I'm just saying the kind of thing Bombavrick was putting his finger on, namely that there's what's going on when it comes to the capitalist earning a return is that the market value of the capital good measured in overall, you know, the consumption basket, if you will, the way you're going to measure what's the real standard of living over time, that can change. And so that's why, in particular, the original purchase price of the tractor might be less than the future revenues it's expected to yield. Okay, but you can't have that sort of disjoint if it's just the same good in the economy in all time periods. Again, because of the spot price at any moment has to just be one. All right, so again, in a too good model where the only consumption good is apples and the only production good is apple trees, I can illustrate Bombavirk's concerns and show that the mere fact that an apple tree physically produces a flow of apples over time, that does not by itself pin down and guarantee you that a capitalist who has money in period one and invests, you know, that he has money that he could go buy apples with, that then if he invests in the apple tree down the road, could then sell the apple tree for money, use the money to buy apples, and he would have more total apples at that point than he originally had at period one. That's what it would mean to be able to earn a net rate of return measured in apples. And the mere fact that trees physically produce apples is not enough to pin down that there's a positive interest rate. Because right, I just walked you through and showed you how it's possible that that world could be consistent with a 0% rate of interest. Okay. In contrast, if the way you're trying to think through this stuff, you're like, oh, let's keep it real simple. Let's just have one good as our baseline case and work out the math and the intuition there. No, you're pinning yourself down in a very simplified framework where it doesn't generalize. Because in that extremely simplistic world where the capital good and the consumption good are the same thing, where it's not apple trees producing apples, but as it said, it's something like sheep producing more sheep over time, there you're going to erroneously conclude, oh, yes, the mere fact that 100 sheep now produce 105 sheep next period means the real rate of interest measured in sheep is positive. And so if sheep are the consumption good, if they're the proxy for, quote, consumption in general, and this little model we're using, aha, I've proven it, a real rate of return. And no, that's not right, because, again, in general, consumption and capital goods are different. All right, so that's what's going on, and that's why in these mainstream models, again, the math is correct. In the little world of the model, there's nothing wrong going on. But where mainstream economists, I think 98% of them, walk away from these derivations thinking something wrong, it's because they see, interest is equal to marginal product of capital, when that's only because in that simplistic world, the physical marginal product of the capital good and the real rate of return from someone investing in it, they happen to be the same number, only again because of the fact that, well, the capital good and consumption good always have to exchange at par, not because of the economics, but because of the same physical thing. And that's what's driving the result. In general, the amount of the increment to output that you get from adding one more unit of the capital good has nothing directly to do with the real rate of return from investing in that capital good. Because again, there's a disjoint. It's, you need to know what's the purchase or what's the market value of the capital good expressed in terms of that consumption good. Okay. Well, that was a pretty long, hey, just one more thing, folks, that I tacked on at the end there. But since I started going down that path, I thought I might as well explain it fully. Hopefully some of you, it finally clicked. And again, if you want to see it spelled out in greater detail, you can check out the links at bobmurphyshow.com/26. Thanks for listening, everybody, and I will catch you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.